Unfortunately, I'm going to have to interrupt you at that point, but it's rather a good point to interrupt, because it's the connection, it's the psychoanalysis and the novel. So it's now our turn to speak. I just thought to say something at the beginning. I wanted to invoke a character from The Other Side of You, a very minor character, but one I love. That is Lenny. Some may remember Lenny, the recovered schizophrenic, who...
He's not very recovered.
No, he's not very recovered, but he's a very loyal friend to David McBride, yes. A very loyal and dear friend, and he's a six-foot frame with a yellow bobble hat on. I think he comes to life. But Lenny invokes his grandma, about with a great philosophical thought that everything connects. And later on in the book, at a learned conference, Gus Garland gets up and uses Lenny's grandma to speak to a point, as I say, in a learned conference. So I thought maybe, you know, anything we speak of in here, we can talk about Freud and free association, but we can also just say that I hope that people feel free to talk and that everything connects. So.
Lenny's grandma is one of my favourite characters because she's a character who never actually appears, but she's referred to. I'm not sure she really exists.
Isn't she referred to, if David McBride giving the lecture,
yes.
Doesn't he say, and a British colleague of ours?
Yes.
And then Gus asks him, who was the colleague? Lenny's grandma. We should get her to give the paper next time.
That's right.
So, I like that very much.
Well, Lenny's grandma has stifled them all with her with her tremendous wisdom.
Yeah, everything.
Can you say in what way Jungian your training and your work enabled you to bring to life characters and your energy to then leave, or not leave, but anyways, put into form your stories?
The question is, in what way did my Jungian training inform my decision to become a writer, or the actual process of writing?
The actual process of writing.
The actual process
of
writing.
Did it enable in some way?
Well, I'm asked this question a lot because, you know, obviously, if you make a career change at a particular point, people always want to know what that's about and how it happens. I think in some way, not at all, is the answer. Because I think in many ways, it's the other way around, that actually my experience of reading literature, I mean, I get into trouble for saying this sometimes, but... You know, there it is. I think really, in some ways, my experience of reading literature enabled me to work better as a psychotherapist. I don't know how much the study of psychotherapy, in its theoretical form anyway, has informed my writing, but I do think the practice of it did in a strange way, and not in the way that people sometimes rather vulgarly imagine, that I was sort of sitting there like a Hoover absorbing material, which I could then bag and, you know, re-churn out in my characters, which is a rather awful thought. I think it was simply this, and I'm sure many of you sitting in the room will recognize this, that I think to listen accurately, to listen well anyway, who knows if we listen accurately, to listen well to another, you have to find some place within yourself that corresponds with the other in some form or other, that speaks the other's language or is receptive to the other's language. I have no doubt that the practice of that was an invaluable discipline for finding this sort of point of gravity for the characters I was writing, who in every other way were very unlike myself. So if I'm writing a man, and I especially like doing male characters, I can find quite... I mean, not every man, obviously. So, you know, the kind of man I write about will be limited by my own male side and my own... the elements of the masculine me that I can recognise and relate to. But finding that male side in me in order to communicate in a particular kind of way with the men I was seeing as patients, undoubtedly nourished that capacity to work easily with male characters. And similarly, you know, the virgin, spinster, repressed Miss Garnett, I hope I'm right in saying, doesn't bear very much resemblance to her author. And yet she's a very recognisable element in her author's psyche because, and I'm sure, I don't mean the people I worked with made that space, but they enabled me to work easily from that space within me. Does that make sense?
Yes, so you're talking about being able to hear the other voice.
Yes, but the other voice, you see, as it were, like a baby chaffinch hearing the song of its parent, goes in somewhere, and although the baby chaffinch can't sing until a certain stage, the very fact it hears the chaffinch's voice enables it to sing at a later... So I use this image because I use birds a lot. You know, so if you imagine within me baby chaffinch, baby vulture, baby... Did you catch the vulture joke, by the way, in Three Roads?
Yes.
I make a vulture...
Yes. Bernardo.
Yes. So that's... It was the practice, not the theory, that I think has been most
definitely
helpful.
I was just wondering about the timing, because you didn't write your books before.
Don't think I could do them together, because they come from too much of the same place.
Mine's a very trivial question, actually.
No, we like trivial questions. Okay. Trivial comes from
from
three.
Sally, and I wondered if you are really spelling your name with an IE. Were you christened with that name, with an IE?
I'm christened EY.
Oh, EY. Oh, so that is the real spelling, is it?
Yes, it comes from a poem by Yeats called Down by the Sally Gardens.
Oh, right.
Which is also a song. My father was a great Yeats lover and lover of Ireland, and my mother was very fond of Benjamin Britten. It's a beautiful, it's set by music, it's a music set by Benjamin Britten, and it actually means willow in Irish. They're willow gardens. It comes from Salix, Salicis, willow, Latin.
I might just add an E to mine.
It's copyright.
Just a quick question about Venice, basically. When you return to Venice, I mean, how does it still impact on you emotionally? In the same way, or does it change?
It's interesting. After writing the book, after writing Miss Garnett's Angel, I didn't go back to Venice until last year. And until then, I'd gone there every year. So it had this rather sort of negative effect on me that I somehow didn't want to go back. Now, I haven't really allowed myself to think why that might be. There are lots of reasons I could come up with, and I couldn't give you an honest answer. But I did have one very moving experience when I went back to Venice. I describe in Miss Garnett's Angel a rather scruffy-looking trattoria in the corner of the Campo. Well, a little while ago, I got an email from the people who'd taken that over. And they wrote to thank me because they said that they were going to have to close the business down. But so many people had come clutching Miss Garnett's Angel. They not only were able to run the business, but they were able to expand it. They now had two shops. They now sold wine. And they would like to know if they could sell copies of Miss Garnett's Angel in the shop. And when I went there, they gave me a meal. And it really is a wonderful, it's now a marvelous place to eat. So I do feel actually I have done some good in the world.
Thank you.
Just sticking with place, Mr. Golightly's Holiday is set on Dartmoor.
Yes.
I have family connections nearby, and I'm just intrigued to know your connection with that part of the world, because obviously, as you said, you write from knowledge of a place.
Well, my first analyst lived down there. I think it's the first time I've ever said that in public. So I got to know it when I used to go, and he actually practiced in London, but sometimes he would take times off when he was writing himself and I would go and see him down there. So that's my first experience with it. The way I came to write Mr. Golightly is in itself quite interesting because I went to visit a very old friend with whom I'd lost touch and who got back in touch with me because she'd read Miss Garnett's Angel. I mean, Miss Garnett has brought me back a great number of lost contacts. I owe that old lady a great debt. She's done me a lot of good. This old friend who'd gone away and done other things and we'd lost contact with each other wrote to me and said, you know, I've read your book and I would love to see you again. And the way I tell the story, which is not quite true, because you should never quite trust a storyteller, they're always a little slippery with their facts. The way I tell it is I went to stay with her a weekend and stayed a year and a half. A year and a week, I mean. Actually, I went to stay a weekend. She invited me back. I went back to stay with her during the Christmas holidays, and then I did stay a year and a week, because during that period, during the time I was staying with her the second time, I woke up at 3 a.m. and the idea of Mr. Golightly had arrived. And Mr. Golightly seemed to want to spend his holiday down on Dartmoor. So you can see it was a very good friendship. And that is the origin of the soap opera, because I, as a matter of fact, have never ever watched a soap opera, but my friend always watched Neighbours. So every evening we used to have a drink. The rule was that we never saw each other in the day, but my rent was to make her dinner every evening. So I would go in every evening, we would have a glass of wine together, and she'd be watching Neighbours. And that's how it got caught into the story of Mr. Golightly's Holiday. I couldn't have done it otherwise. I didn't ever know what Neighbours... Well, I knew what Neighbours was, but I'd never watched it. So that was the origin of my association with Dartmoor.
I would like to thank you both for a wonderful opportunity to free associate, which I think Michael, really, and yourself have invited us to do. What came to my mind was when you started to describe the idea that you had written the same book, was that it reminded me of patients who at certain points say, I'm sure I've told you this before, which always strikes me as a wonderful mixture of resistance and aggression and a kind of a sense of togetherness, all at the same time. So on the one hand, say, why the bloody hell have you forgotten? The sense, therefore, of fearing that they're boring me. But at the same time, there's this thought of somehow there is a moment of togetherness and a recognition of time past. Now, what I'm wondering about is, if it's true that, okay, patients tell the same story over and over again, in fact they don't, because the emotional climate changes each time they tell it, and what happens in that process is a development of being. And what the French calls subjectivation, in other words, becoming a subject. And what I wanted to ask you was whether you had noticed, first of all in your work as a therapist, and then in your work as a novelist, whether there was a kind of parallel in the development of your being, and whether it was in any way similar, or whether there were some really fundamental differences. Because it struck me that if it's true that the development of an emotional climate and the change is what we are in some ways seeking to do in our work as psychotherapists, is the thought that somehow a novelist is doing the same, not just for themselves, but for this thing called a reader?
Well, that's an enormously deep and interesting question. And I mean, I would start by just saying, you know, as everybody here knows, repetition is one of the core concepts of psychoanalysis. And indeed, it is a core concept in all storytelling. I mean, you get it more particularly, I think, in poetry, but the notion of repetition is something, you know, a rose is a rose is a rose. It's not the same thing as a rose. And it's a very mysterious business, repetition, and I don't think that theory, analytic theory or literary theory, has quite got to the bottom of it. I wasn't quite sure what you meant if you were asking me to consider a parallel between a patient's development and the so-called repeated anecdote and my own progress as a novelist. Was that what you want me to comment on? or my own experience working with somebody repeating and my own experience as a novelist. I mean, in a way, they're sort of all part of the same question. I do think that you're absolutely right. I always used to sort of sit up and take notice when people said, I'm sure I've told you this before, or words to that effect, because it's also how it's put is interesting. Because there are lots of different things one can say to that or not, or think about them. But I do agree with you. I think that although something's old, it's also always new, because the two people sitting in the room are never quite the same. When the story comes up, it's never told quite the same. Different elements will be stressed. What was worn or what was said or who said what to whom will probably come across rather differently. So it never is the same story. And it also indicates, as you've indicated, and we all know, something that is lying undigested in the system that needs something happening to it. And I do think it's part of a process of being. And certainly, for myself, there's a development that happens with the writing of the rewriting of each story in a different way. I mean, I was very struck when I went to America for my second novel, Instances of the Number Three, and I was interviewed by a young journalist who said, and this hasn't come up actually, interestingly, tonight, but he said to me, it seems to me, Miss Vickers, you're very preoccupied with death. I hadn't really thought about that very much. So I said, oh, sort of, am I? And he said, yes. And he read out to me the opening of Miss Garnett's Angel and the opening of Instances of the number three. And the opening of Miss Garnett's Angel goes like this. Death is outside life, but it alters it. It leaves a hole in the fabric of things, which those who are left behind try to repair. And the opening of the Instances of the number three, I'm misquoting it the way everyone else does now, shows how bad habits are catching. The opening of Instances of the Number Three goes like this. After Peter Hansom died, people were surprised that his widow seemed to be spending so much time with his mistress. Now, I actually hadn't noticed that both these books start with a death.
And the other side of you.
Well, by that time, I'd sort of cottoned on a bit. But
starts with a death.
I really hadn't noticed. Now, you might... You know, the interviewer didn't believe me. He obviously thought this was a pose. But I hadn't, because the tone is so different. And what I was going to do with it was so different. But actually, if you look at it, it's the same story. Somebody dies, leaves some people behind. The people are affected by the death and look at life themselves and the dead person differently. It's the same story. But it doesn't feel like that to the person telling it, because the person's got something on their mind which they haven't got off their chest or out of their mind into yours or whatever it is you're doing. That's not a total answer, but it's my free association answer.
Thank you for that. That's all I wanted.
Another question in relation to psychotherapy. Do you think that studying fiction might be as important and as relevant as studying psychoanalytic theory in psychotherapy trainings in relation to clinical work?
Well, I'm afraid I do.
I'm glad.
And when I did a bit of teaching myself to psychotherapists, I would generally teach works of fiction. I did quite a lot of fairy stories, which, as you know, are allowed in through the back door as sort of elements of theoretical training, particularly among Jungians. I also did myths, which, you know, have a degree of respectability. But I did a lot of Shakespeare as well. And I found that particularly if I want, I had a personal aversion to using case studies. And because I had read a good deal of English literature, I could always find a suitable character in a book or play by Shakespeare who would illustrate rather better than a person I'd actually met in life any kind of point I wanted to make. So I found them fabulously useful as well. But I do think, and this is a serious point, I do think everything is stories. I mean, people... come to tell a story, don't they? And I often think the work of a good analyst or therapist is like the work of a good editor. And a good editor doesn't work quite the way people think. They don't say, no, I think you shouldn't write about Venice, I think you should write about Berlin, whatever. It isn't like that at all. They say, I wasn't quite sure what you meant when you said this, or it's interesting that you stop here, or I don't know if you've noticed, but you've mentioned whiskey in...
Is this something you want to say, Mike? Were you...
No, no, when's this finished?
So I think that there's... you know, I found a lot of parallels between being edited and being analysed.
I just thought you might be comforted to know, Sally, that my first ever teacher of psychotherapy, who was a Jungian analyst when I was doing my psychiatric training, was asked by somebody in our junior psychiatrists group, what do we need to read for psychotherapy? What texts should we be reading, thinking of Freud, Jung, or whatever? And what he said was the Bible and Shakespeare.
Yes.
Of course, he said, you've got to read your Freud, read Jung, there are, you know, all these important analysts that you have to read, but you saturate yourself in the Bible and Shakespeare before anything else, which I thought was good advice.
Yes, it's very good advice, and you've obviously taken it.
Just about this overlap of what the arena and of writing and literature might be, and what project in the arena of psychoanalysis might be. Because in some ways, in the discussion, I thought, between the two of you, the bits that Michael chose, or that you chose for you to read out, in a way, gathered around that sense of what the commonality of the project between the work of art and our response and immersion in it, and our immersion in an analysis, whether as the practitioner or the patient, can lead to and might evoke. And it seemed as if, in some kind of way, that around that area of the overlap of you having been one kind of practitioner and becoming another, seems like coming at the same set of issues from two different disciplines.
Oh, I'm sure it is. I'm certain that's true. One of the things that, you see, I don't want to say I was trying to write about, but one of the things that emerged, I hope emerged, I felt emerged in the other side of you, was this idea I had while I was writing the book, actually. And I wrote the first part of the book, which is the psychiatrist and analyst David McBride, faced with this woman who has made a very serious suicide attempt and not knowing what her story is, which is not an uncommon experience. I mean, you know, of course, it's quite interesting to people who are not in this profession, but it's not at all uncommon for people in it. What was interesting, and again, you'll probably find this easier to believe than other people do, I didn't know what her story was either. And I went to Australia, and while I was in Australia, by coincidence, I was in Melbourne, and Neville Symington came to Melbourne to give a series of seminars on what happens when you're in a room with another person. And by luck, I could go to almost all of them. Just happened that my engagements worked, so I could go, and I said, you know, can I come? I'm here, can I come? And he said, of course. So I went to that, and while I was listening to Neville talking about what happens when you're in a room with another person, there filtered into my mind this thought, it's very like the story of the journey to Emmaus. You know, there's two people on a road walking along, and suddenly, lo and behold, there's a third person, but you don't know who the hell this other person is, or who the heaven the other person is. And then I got back to London, and I went to the National Gallery, which is a thing I do. I don't necessarily go to the National Gallery, but I quite often go and look at paintings, just sort of, well, I look at paintings anyway, but I often do it when I'm sort of ruminating on things. And I re-encountered the Caravaggio painting of the Supper at Emmaus. And, you know, I sort of went, well, this sort of wonderful image of Keats's again, things dovetailed in my mind. And the story of Elizabeth Cruikshank, the Road to Emmaus, Neville's seminars, and the Caravaggio painting all made a wonderful sort of movement and came together. And I think what I was trying to do in that book was write about the way, and it came up in your question about the reader and the writer. You know, I always say that I only produce a part of a book. The other part is produced by the reader. And it's the marriage between the writer and the reader that makes the book. It's the third entity. And when you're in a room with another person, of course, out of the two presences in the room, a third identity emerges, which is the truth you've made together, the story you've made together. It's exactly like the story of the Road to Emmaus, which is in a very strange story, only appears in the Gospel according to St. Luke. It's very like a fairy story, you know, if you look at it. It's one of those stories, I'm sure, whoever Luke was, he brought an old story in to tell a story about Jesus and the resurrection, because it isn't like any of the other resurrection stories. It only appears in Luke. And I think it's a marvelous story about what can happen between two people when they're looking for a reality, that reality is something that emerges between two. And it's also what happens with the work of art. You know, if you're looking at a painting, something happens between the artist and you, which the work of art is a vessel for, a vehicle for. But something about the artist's vision and the viewer's vision merges and makes a creative third. So it won't have escaped your notice that I'm quite interested in three. There are instances of the number three. There's the other side of you, which is a quotation from Eliot's The Wasteland. But who is that on the other side of you? So it's two people in a third, where three roads meet. It's also about this third option, this third entity that is, and that I think links with the spider quotation in Mr. Golightly, that, you know, somehow we're forever making a third. And I think that's where the arena of psychotherapy and the arena of writing a story for readers overlap or have things to say to each other.
Yes, I just wanted to come in and remind you of an experience that we both shared earlier this year, Sally. We were at a conference together, and what you've been saying about the Road to Emmaus reminds me that we heard somebody read a poem that he'd written about the Road to Emmaus, if you remember. And the gist, the idea behind the poem was to show these two people walking along, finding that they had somebody else with them, and it was never clear to them who this other presence was. But at the end of the experience, when this other presence disappeared, they were both left feeling more distinctly their own selves than they had been at the beginning. And I'm very much reminded of that by what you're saying, because, you know, in one way we could see that this is the role of the psychoanalyst, but now I'm seeing also how much it's the role of the writer to have to remain undefined in a certain way, which allows the other person to experience more about who they are.
Interestingly, that particular person sent me that poem when he read.
Oh, really? How interesting.
So you've had the same thought. Yes, I think the experience, I mean, certainly the disciples, I mean, when they finally recognize that the third presence is in fact the man they have believed dead and have been mourning, and he's returned to life again, and at the moment of recognition he disappears, which I think is also an interesting, and which was an element in this particular poem. I think the theme of presence and non-presence is something that interests me very much as well. I said that Lenny's grandma was one of my favourite characters. I have a number of favourite characters. Harriet is one in Miss Garnett's Angel. The character who is there but isn't there at the same time. You know, it's the presence and the non-presence. And I think that a successful analysis will leave the person more themselves without leaving too much mark of the analyst or therapist, obviously, upon them. And, you know, when I was having my humorous exchange with Michael about David McBride and the possibility between him and Elizabeth Cruikshank, I said I remain agnostic about her. Well, I still do, only because I'm happier if people make up their own minds about what a character does than if I direct them towards a particular set of beliefs about that character, because I don't feel that's what I want to do. I want to create a presence that you will relate to as much as you might relate to somebody you met at my dinner table. I mean, it's no good me saying, I love this person, she's my best friend, you have to like her. It wouldn't work, would it?
I haven't read your recent book, but it's been a little while since I've read the others. But if I remember, on the other side of you, there's an implicit critique of psychoanalytic practice by the character. I assume that there clearly is some kind of critique of Freud's theory or viewpoint in this recent one. What, you've been saying all kinds of great stuff in relating the psychoanalytic experience to literature and to the same. What is your, not your characters, but your own, you know, critique of the process that you've been talking about in positive terms?
Well, first of all, you have to remember the character's a character in The Other Side of You. So his critique is not my critique. And I'm only saying this because it's the commonest question one has to... I mean, this is a very crude example of it, but very early in the days when I first wrote Miss Garnett's Angel, after I first got invited round to do things, I would frequently turn up at events and I'd stand there. And after a bit, people would ignore me, and after a bit, they'd say, and yes, can we help? And I'd say, yes. They'd say, have you come to the Sally Vickers event? And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, they'd sort of look a bit irritated, and I'd say, actually, I am Sally Vickers. And they would look absolutely astounded, because they expected me to be a little old lady, you see. No, but really, they did. I mean, really. And it's rather like imagining that Shakespeare was a murderer because he can write Macbeth. So I want to emphasize that any critique made by any of my characters is the character and not me, first of all. And that is true of this book too, Where Three Roads Meet. There is a critique of Freud. But actually all I'm really doing is taking Freud at face value with his words. There are a number of things he actually says, and seeded in among my own version of Freud are Freud's words. So at a number of points, I'm slightly, gently teasing him about things that I think actually, if pressed, he probably, at the end of his life, would have revised. Because, as you know, Freud was, one of his great strengths was an ability to develop and change his mind. I think, you know, it's a misreading of Freud to see him as just one person. I was, of course, obviously tackling him on the Oedipus myth, where I think he missed a few tricks that would have done his theory more service than the way he particularly used it, because I don't think he read the myth particularly well. But I'm going to be a bit mean, and I'm not going to give a critique. Well, no, that's simply the character. That particular character needed to come out of a cul-de-sac he'd got himself into, where he couldn't himself understand his own past because he was unwilling to feel certain things. And the only way he could do that was by taking the step he took. It's not something, and I probably should emphasize that in this company, that I am sort of recommending to everybody. I mean, there's a famous story about Jung which always annoys me, actually, because it's sometimes quoted by people in a rather self-congratulatory way. I think it's quite a shocking story. But, you know, he did these things, and, you know, and so did Freud. I mean, there's a story about some poor bloke turning up and Freud opening the door and saying, Freudian slip. Jung opening the door. I don't think Freud would ever have done this. Jung opening the door and saying, go away, you bore me. Now, okay, we all feel that at times, but it is, you know, I would never in a million years dream of recommending it as a way of carrying on. So I really want to emphasize, you know, this is a book about somebody who happens to do something I happen to know something about, and therefore could take some liberties with, because I'm easy with it. But I don't want it to be read as a particular critique. I want it to be read as a book about the impact of a certain way of working and thinking upon a particular man in a particular set of situations. Otherwise, it becomes a sort of quasi-manual, and I don't want it to be read like that.
Slightly going back to the question of the repetitions, as it were, but I was also going, when there was a comment about what literature was recommended, reminded very much of the lectures that John Pardell gave.
Yes.
And it's clear at times when he was trying to tell us about some theory of Freud or Melanie Klein, and you can see a sort of glazed look coming.
Yes.
He would then tell us a story from a Greek poem. So I think perhaps the Greek literature should be added to the Bible and Shakespeare. And I gather Goethe thought that Shakespeare was really rather romantic. But anyway, not Goethe, but I'll leave that story. What I was going to say is that when somebody says, I've told you this before, I wonder if what was thought to be a sort of aggressive component is, you didn't do so brilliantly on your free associations last time, can we have another go at it? And you see if you can do better or different. And I wonder if, in a sense, if it is rewriting the same story, what you and your readers are wanting.
I would tend to sort of downplay the aggressive component, actually, in this repetition. But then, you know, we Jungians are kind of, you know, a bit namby-pamby when it comes to aggression. We tend to shove it under the carpet. I didn't ever myself find it particularly aggressive. I thought it was more apologetic and more, I don't want to bore you, but... not so much, you haven't done your stuff, mate. Though possibly that too. I can't help thinking of The Hunting of the Snark. You know, I've told you sit three times, so it's true. There's something about repetition which validates as well. And to return to my theme of reality, there's a lot about it in this. I have Tiresias. I mean, I would certainly recommend the Greek myths, but I think they implicitly are, because after all, the most central pivot to Freud's theory depends upon a Greek myth, albeit, I think, not adequately unravelled. I mean, I have Freud make his sort of rather super rational remarks about the place of the gods and the place of religion in human civilization and human consciousness. And I have Tiresias say what I really believe to be true, which is he says, yeah, but, you know, these Greek gods, there's nothing superstitious about them. They're the invisible realities. And they're much more like the laws of physics, the Greek gods. You know, if you tread on a sacred snake, you get a wound in your foot, which doesn't heal, whether you meant to tread on that snake or not, whatever the hell you were doing, you still get bitten by the sacred snake. If you step out of a plane, even if you imagined you were stepping onto an escalator, you still fall to the ground and break your neck. And the Greek gods are much more like that. They're not these rather romanticized creatures in sandals and helmets and so on. They're the things which we think we can control, but can't control. They're what cannot be willed and cannot be controlled. I think they're sort of, you know, they're Faber-esque figures. You can't buck an oracle. You can't will a Greek god to do what he or she doesn't want to do. They're what's there, like it or lump it, if you see what I mean. And I think in that sense they fit in much better with Freud's theory than he allowed. I think he was a little bit the victim of this has been written about a great deal, of wanting to seem super respectable, wanting to seem super rational, super scientific. But his imagination worked in a very different sort of a way.
This is what what you say about kindness, isn't it? You have Tiresias pointing out near the end of Where Three Ways Meet that kindness, of course, is good, and I think we could trace kindness as a sort of underground theme through a lot of your writing. But Tiresias points out that it was an act of kindness, the shepherd who wouldn't let Oedipus as a baby die on the mountainside, that set in train the whole process that leads to the tragedy. So things turn out how they're going to turn out. It's very important what you've just been saying, I think.
I am interested in kindness, and of course I'm always very interested in the etymology of a word. I mean, it's very interesting to me that it comes from the root of kin. And I think my concept of real kindness is this ability to recognize one's kinship with the other in spite of one's impossible differences. And I do write about it a great deal. And Michael's absolutely right. I have Tiresias point out that when we do a kindly act, the outcome is not necessarily what we hope it will be. And equally, when we perform a perfidious act, it's equally, you know, it's not unusual for it to have a more positive outcome. That, you know, we don't know the outcomes of the actions we perform. But I think that notion of kinship and kindness is something I do explore a lot in the books. And I think the Oedipus myth is in many ways a kinship myth, and the ways in which we are and aren't kin, and the ways and it seems to me the great taboo that is broken is not so much the sexual taboo, but the parental one of subjecting a child to, I mean, the infanticide of the child performed by the parents. It seems very interesting to me that that is almost ignored by, well, effectively ignored by Freud.
I have to bring in the reality of time, but Michael, do you want just to ask your final...
Oh, no, there was something I wanted to ask, but I'll see if I can condense it into half a minute. The Baal Shem Tov... In The Other Side of You, Sally has one of the characters tell a story about the Baal Shem Tov who would avert disaster for his people by going into a sacred glade in the forest, lighting a fire, saying a prayer, and disaster would be averted. And his successor forgets the prayer. And that the successor of that man forgets how to light the fire. And the successor of that man loses his way and doesn't know where the sacred glade in the forest is. And so finally we're left with somebody who, when doom is approaching, says, Lord, I don't know what to do. I don't know where the sacred glade is. I don't know how to light the fire. I've forgotten the prayer if I ever knew it. But I can tell the story.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me so significant. Mm. You put that into a story that you're telling about a woman who, to begin with, can't tell her story and then can. And what it's saying is, what we have is the story, but behind that, the invisible layerings that have gone to the making of the story. And had we time, I'd like to know what you might be able to say about that.
Well, there is a tiny little bit at the end of... Oh dear, now can I find my way around my own book? I mean, there's so much in what you've just said. Ah, here we are, hooray. This is the conversation between Tiresias towards the end of the book. And it's when he, and I'll just read this bit, and maybe that's a good point to finish. And this is Tiresias, and this is the most terrible irony of all. The attempt to outwit the oracle was needless, for its subtle prophecy had already been fulfilled. Before he was taken from his mother's breast, Oedipus had lain with her 3 days and 3 blissful nights, She told us so herself, that dreadful day in the throne room. 3 days and three nights, during which the thought of the male child lying in a bed with his mother must have been a living death to his father. You can't escape an oracle. You can merely find ways and means to live with it. If only they could have let things be. And Freud says they couldn't bear to. Events must be endured if they are to disclose their meaning. Tiresias says, or unfold untold meanings. And no one, even you, Doctor, has ever quite accounted for humankind's resistance to letting well alone. Or for misfortune's strong allure. It was in the blood of that mismatched couple's ill-starred son, imbibed with his mother's milk and drilled into his bone. Freud says, naturally, he would have the same tendency. And Tiresias says, and with their atrocity against him, the seeds of all the forthcoming tragedy were sown. He carried it with him, the impress of that unholy assault, until it found its way back into daylight through his own person. You see, it's not the gods that cause tragedy, Doctor. It's we mortals who misconstrue the signs from our mortal fear of mortality. Or immortality, Doctor? Certainly he made his story into an immortal one, so far as any story is. And Tiresias says, but Dr. Freud, stories are all we humans have to make us immortal.